this is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of July, and this week Congress seems to have realized that the unemployment benefits in the CARES Act are running out at the end of this month. Both houses of Congress spent several weeks on recess from June into July, with no real effort to reach a bipartisan deal on continuing coronavirus-related aid before they left, and meanwhile, coronavirus infections have surged in the South and in the Southwest especially. Democrats passed their own one-party relief package through the House of Representatives back in May, which would have spent over $3 trillion, including on extensive aid to state and local governments. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at the time called the Democrats' bill an unserious liberal wish list. But Senate Republicans didn't pass a plan of their own, nor did the Trump administration propose one in any detail. This past week, having gotten back in town, Republicans have been negotiating with each other and have almost reached an agreement on what their opening bid to Democrats will be. One thing we know is the Trump administration has dropped its demand not to spend new money on testing or the Centers for Disease Control. This was, for obvious reason, a top priority for members of both parties in Congress. The president also isn't looking likely to get some of his otter ideas, like a payroll tax cut during a time when so many people are out of work and not paying the payroll tax. But there's still much to be resolved both within the Republican Party and then between the parties about how much aid to give and how it should be structured. And state unemployment agencies, which are already overwhelmed by the volume of unemployment claims, will have to take time to distribute aid under any new formula that Congress ultimately agrees on. So it's likely that whatever the resolution, people who have been relying on unemployment benefits are going to be receiving them in significantly reduced amount for some number of weeks. Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist of the Washington Post on the right. And on the left, Christine Emba, also a columnist of the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Josh.
So, Megan, one thing I keep hearing from Democrats is that Democrats are asking here for policies that would help President Trump get reelected, policies that would keep the economy afloat, that would keep household finances afloat, but that officials in the Trump administration, with one key exception, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, seem to be bizarrely resistant to that and are actively seeking out policies that would hurt the economy and hurt the president's reelection chances. Do you agree with that analysis?
I think yes, in a lot of ways. I mean, one thing that's just obvious is that the level of uncertainty is not helping. It is true that often these things come down to last minute negotiations, but the fact that everything has been so all over the place that it wasn't even clear that Republicans were actually going to sit down and do this until recently, that's not good for the economy. People need to be able to plan. Of course, there's already a high background level of uncertainty, but the administration really needed to get its act together much earlier and not insist on the ridiculous payroll tax cut, which was not going to help the people who are actually causing the economic damage, which is the people who are unemployed and unemployable until we get COVID under control. And so I think, yes, absolutely. You know, Donald Trump needed to be more proactive on the economic side as well as on the virus control side. But I think the bigger story really is the lack of virus control, right? We should have packages to help people who have been thrown out of work through no fault of their own, to help them get through, to try to, you know, prevent this from spiraling into just an utter economic crisis. But that said, economic damage repair is virus control. And if you don't do that, and that is where the administration, in my opinion, has fallen down in a much bigger way, then the economic package is almost beside the point.
Yeah, I mean, Christine, when Megan talks about these things often come down to the wire in Washington, I think the model for that is government shutdowns, where either the federal government closes much of its operation for a few days, or they almost get to a shutdown, but there's an agreement at 11:30 p.m. that pushes it out for another 2 weeks, at which point you have another deadline. But that's stuff where we've sort of gotten used to turning the government on and off. It involves a few million employees, which is significant in the economy, but those employees have a strong sense that, you know, that ultimately Congress will pass a bill to make up their back pay at the end of the government shutdown, because that's what they've done before. So government shutdowns, while they're disruptive, they don't tend to affect the economy very much, and they don't tend to have, you know, really big, long-lasting negative effects. Here, the issue is you have all this stuff where it's you can't just turn it on and off like a switch. If you change the unemployment benefits formula, you have to push this down through 50 state agencies that hand out the unemployment benefits. Their computer systems are old. It takes them a long time to get this stuff under control. Megan talks about the virus control. That's an even longer lead time, where you finally agree on money to spend on something, and then you have to manufacture things and develop new competencies. And so it seems like, you know, if we're talking about that as business as usual, that these things come down to the wire, that was much less acceptable here than it is with some of the other things that Congress unacceptably takes down to the wire.
Right, absolutely. I mean, in this moment and in this crisis we're facing, brinksmanship is not an attractive option. It's not an option at all, because in fact, we are on the brink. We've been on the brink. Maybe we've even fallen off the cliff at this point. Right now, the American people, I think, have no appetite for silly games played in Washington where there's 1 week off and 1 week on. The stakes are much higher here than which party gets to walk triumphantly into the room and announce that their bill won eventually. These are people who are going hungry, who are going to die of an illness, who will be long-term unemployed, whose children will not learn to read and write because schools are closed. Game time is over here, and everybody knows it.
Megan, you talk about virus mitigation as being the number one economic agenda item here, in addition to being obviously the number one public health agenda item here. What do you do about that at this point? Because I look at that sort of not completely hopelessly, but with a great deal of dejection, in the sense that a lot of the things we're talking about now are things that we should have been doing starting in January. The administration's argument for why they didn't want more money for testing and for the Centers for Disease Control and such is that a lot of the money that's been appropriated already, they haven't spent yet. And it's like, well, why haven't you spent it? And if you start trying to spend that money in earnest now, it's on things where you won't enjoy the benefits of it immediately. It's going to take a fair amount of time. So I don't like. I agree with you. That's the number one most important thing to do right now. I just feel very negatively about the prospect of the federal government, even if the Trump administration changed its attitude about this stuff and wanted to be a lot more effective, about the timescale that we would need for that efficacy to actually matter.
Don't get me wrong. I am not suggesting that virus control should be substituting for the fact that we actually have to figure out what we are doing economically. I think Republicans have some good arguments that, you know, people shouldn't be making more money to stay home and be unemployed than they were when they were working. And that formula needs to be somehow adjusted so that it's a little less, gives people a little fewer disincentives to work when virus is under control. That said, you know, we are now at the 11th hour. We have to make sure that people can still pay their rent, can still put food on the table and do all of the things that they need to do to stay alive in a very difficult time for Americans. You know, I agree with you. There's absolutely a long lead time. But you know what? You know, the best time to have done all this was January. The second best time is today. So,
Christine, what would you do if you were Congress?
If I were Congress,
yes.
Well, that would be
embodied all
an exciting shift for me. You know, I think that my priorities would be aligned with what the Democrats are pushing now and what the Republicans seem slowly willing to get on board with, having actually realized that, again, this is no moment for brinksmanship and games. This is a real problem. Expanding unemployment benefits. So many people have lost jobs. You know, we have seen a skyrocketing unemployment rate. I think 1.4 million more people filed for unemployment benefits just last week. We need to get money out to people so that they can continue to proceed with their lives in one form or another. That would be my main priority.
Megan, how do you think about how much money is appropriate? The White House say they want a package that's more than $1 trillion. Democrats have numbers that are closer to $3 trillion. At some point, this starts sounding like monopoly money. And certainly, the financial markets don't seem fazed by increased government borrowing. It's not like interest rates are going up because people are worried that the government's borrowing so much money that it can't pay it back. So how do you think about what the right amount of money is to inject into the economy right now?
You know, I think you have to start with what needs to happen. So, for example, for me, I would be looking at, you know, the administration is saying 70% income replacement on unemployment benefits. I would be looking at 100% income replacement on unemployment benefits. I don't think that to any meaningful extent, people at the moment are being disincentivized from work. But, you know, I could negotiate on that 90%, 85%, whatever, you know, whatever that number is. I think it should not be over 100%. You know, you have to start with what kind of money do the schools need to get themselves reopened? This is something the administration's made a priority. Okay, well, it's going to be real expensive, right? And districts are going to need emergency funding to make that happen. You know, how much is that? And I think you have to start at the bottom and build up. But I'm not actually sure I feel like either party has done a very good job of that. You know, the Democrats, it's a sort of giant wish list of everything they've ever wanted to do. Republicans, it's just an arbitrary number.
Yeah. So, Christine, let's talk about the school aid a little bit, because the president has made clear his intention to use this as a tool to push school districts to do full in-person reopenings. That doesn't seem to have a lot of buy-in on either side of the aisle in Congress. And I think, you know, since the president started saying that a few weeks ago, the virus conditions have just gotten worse in such a way that it looks even less realistic than it did then. All that said, it strikes me as true that the financial needs of school districts will will vary depending on what they are doing, and also that just because a school district cannot reopen for in-person instruction in full in August or September doesn't mean that things won't have changed by the middle of the school year, such that to a point where we really do want districts in a lot of the country moving toward fuller in-person reopenings. And if that means modified schedules, they may have increased costs related to staffing, to transportation, that sort of thing. So it seems like if you were trying to be technocratic here, you would want some sort of formula that depended on what the school districts were doing, that looked at the actual style of operations they had and customized the money to that. This just feels like another thing where there's both, the need to do it on the fly means that the federal government will not be able to design that formula in such a way that it actually meets the needs of districts consistently. And then you have also this political overlay on it, where we want districts that are in a good position to reopen in person, to have the money to do that. We don't want them doing that just because of federal financial pressure, if that's going to mean virus spread in their communities. So this feels like, again, an area where you can lay out principles, but it's going to be extremely difficult for the federal government to actually implement them.
I think that one thing that people do tend to forget when we talk about schools being closed is that schools may be closed, buildings may be closed, but teachers are still working. Students still need resources. There is a lot of money that is spent behind the scenes simply to keep the wheels running in our educational system. And if we want that system to be able to persist and still be there for us when we go back in classroom, we do have to pay to keep that money working. You know, that said, again, this is not really a time for the most technocratic and tightly targeted solutions, because this needs to happen right now for schools to be able to function whenever they do reopen. While it would be nice to target funding to school districts and states based on whether they plan to reopen or will reopen in the next several months, we honestly don't know that. Because of our mishandling of this pandemic from the very beginning, it's incredibly hard to predict what the school year will look like a month or two from now, let alone 6 months from now. So I think that we need to just be giving school systems, all the support that we can, and trusting that, in many cases, they really do care about their educational mission. They care about their students, and we want them to be as well prepared, to continue teaching when that becomes possible, whether it's in person or online.
Yeah, Megan, to the extent that one of the goals here is to give schools money they need to operate, how do you figure out what they need?
I think that's really difficult. And I also think that, the districts as they are have different priorities from the parents, and that it's actually, there's no one right now who looks like they're actually going to mediate those in any kind of consistent way. Now, that said, I think conservatives are really exaggerating how much pressure there is for schools to reopen. If you look at polls, it's really not that popular with parents either, but it's really unpopular with teachers. And understandably, right? I see a lot of kind of professional parents out there who are mad at teachers and saying, this is outrageous. Like, look, the grocery store workers are going and the teachers are saying they ought to be allowed to stay home. And the parents aren't getting out there to put themselves in front of a room of, 12 or 30 young natural anarchists with dubious personal hygiene. I think these are really hard questions, but because of that, because the teachers are more organized than the parents are, and they're certainly better entrenched in the Democratic Party, I think you're ending up with a default towards never reopening the schools. And, I think you can make an argument for it, but I also think there are really huge costs to that. There's costs to the kids, in terms of they're just losing a year of education because distance learning might be better in the fall, but it's not going to be that good. They're losing the socialization. And their parents, if they are, say, below 10, are basically losing the ability to do work at home if they're office workers, because their kid is coming in every 10 minutes to be like, mommy, mommy, like, daddy, daddy, look at my dinosaur. And that cost is also enormous. And I don't think that either party is doing a good job of weighing those costs, right? Just Donald Trump is open at all costs, and Democrats are frankly letting the teachers' unions drive them to what I think is probably going to end up being an excessively conservative point on that. We do need, the one thing that we do need to think about, we absolutely have to think about the people who are suffering right now. We also need to think about preserving our economic capacity. We need to not drive firms out of existence because we have, put so much money in unemployment that they can't get their workers back. We need to not drive them out of existence because half of their workforce is home dealing with their children instead of dealing with their workday. We need to find solutions for that. And we are not doing that right now.
Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about some of those issues related to employment. I'll be back with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist at The Washington Post. So Christine, Megan was talking there basically about the need to preserve the workforce, that you need people to be willing to go back to work when jobs are available and the virus situation is back closer to normal, and you need parents to be able to have their sort of normal educational arrangements for their children. And so let's start with that employment issue, because to date, I don't think we're really seeing, and I think Megan would agree to this, that we're not really seeing yet significant problems in the labor market from the fact that unemployment benefits are so generous just because so many jobs are missing. We're also, there's interesting data from Ernie Tedeschi, who's a former Treasury Department economist, about how basically very large fractions of the people who are returning to work are people who were making more than 100% of what they were making at work in unemployment benefits. And if you think about it, it makes sense. The unemployment benefits don't go on forever. So even if the check is generous and you like it, you know that you have to go back to work sooner or later. And if your job is offered to you, it's very likely you're going to take it. But I guess in the longer run, in a more normal economy, you would think that this was a concern. You don't want people to be paid more to not work than to work. And so how do you think about that when you're trying if you're Congress, what do you make those unemployment benefits look like to sort of manage that transition from this very odd time in the economy to what we hope will be a more normal time in the economy some months from now?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. Obviously, it's the one that everybody is thinking about right now. I would say if we were being, you know, extremely forward thinking, talking about unemployment benefits in, say, a resolved normal economy a year or two from now, it might be worth noting that perhaps if people are making more money staying at home on unemployment than they would be at their jobs, and that is in fact appealing to them, then maybe their jobs are not paying them enough. Maybe they are not being paid a fair wage to get them out of the house. But that is a debate for far in the future. In the meantime, right now, I think we can very easily say that there's a perfectly logical incentive for people to stay home, whether they're getting unemployment benefits in excess of their previous jobs or not. And that incentive is there is a pandemic out and people don't want to get COVID. I don't fully understand how or why Republicans could possibly be posturing about this, that we need to, you know, force people out of their homes to work under, you know, threat of illness and death. For what purpose, in fact? We haven't acknowledged the number of jobs that will be permanently lost. It seems to not acknowledge, in fact, that the economy, the service economy, especially where many of these, you know, low-wage jobs are, is not even functioning at full capacity. There are many people who would like, in fact, to be out working, even at a rate lower than their unemployment benefits right now, who simply cannot. You know, it's not necessarily also that people simply want to stay at home and they're, you know, rolling in their cash right now. We just talked about education for a good number of minutes. There are kids at home. People have to take care of their families, children who cannot go to school, who cannot go to daycare. If we want to talk about reopening the economy and getting people back to work, childcare should be, in fact, our number one priority so that parents feel safe leaving their homes.
It's fun to say, like, well, maybe if they don't want to go back to their jobs, then they're just not paying them enough. But a lot of these businesses can't afford to pay more than they are. They don't operate. It's not like the business owners themselves are just rolling in fat profits and they could take some, you know, sell their yacht and pay their workers more. And the fact is that if those businesses are gone when the time comes to reopen, the workers suffer because unemployment benefits aren't going to go on forever. You know, similarly with schools, I absolutely think that we need to be thinking about how are we doing childcare? How are we doing schools? I would absolutely push for that. At the same time, you know, if reopening the schools seeds another epidemic, as it did in Israel, then you have actually done more damage than good. And I think this is going to be a process of feeling your way along trying to make sure that we're preserving as much economic capacity as we can, knowing that some of it may never come back. You know, I'm not sure movie theaters are ever going to reopen. I'm not sure a lot of restaurants and bars are ever going to reopen. I'm not sure that mall retail is ever going to reopen. Because those were trends that were, you know, with the mall retail and the movie theaters, those were trends that were happening before. And I think that COVID has supercharged them. But as much as possible, we need to think about the world beyond COVID and not just say, well, you know, we've got to help people right now. We've got to do the easy, the thing that is best for everyone at the moment, and not think about, okay, but in a year and a half when there's a vaccine, are we going to want to have basically driven every small business in the country under in order to keep unemployment benefits high and to keep the schools closed?
Christine, to your point about that, that if we want people back into the labor force, wages should be higher. I mean, in principle, I'm certainly in favor of higher wages. I just see two concerns about that as a touchstone for the policy about how unemployment insurance should be structured in the long run. One is that when you add on the enhanced unemployment benefit to what a typical minimum unemployment benefit would be in a lot of states, you're talking about replacing something like $18 or $19 an hour, which is higher than even the minimum wages we're tending to see set in some of the high-income, high-wage cities in the country. So I'm not sure that as a national policy, you could say that, you know, that that it's not a concern if that employers can't hire somebody at less than that in the long run. Now, again, I think that there are factors other than the amount of the unemployment benefit. They are time-limited for the individual, even if they are continuing in an ongoing basis. So it's not that people will just sit and collect these checks forever. It's not that it's impossible to hire people, but I think that it can't just be that all wages should be higher than that benefit. The other thing is that we're likely to come out of this in a relatively weak economy. We've had the last few years of economic policy debates with a relatively tight labor market, where if you say, well, you know, to just tell employers to pay more and they'll do it, that's been largely true. As we climb out of the recession that we've been through, I think for at least some, you know, for a couple of years, that approach isn't going to work, because then a lot of employers will just decide not to hire. Now, again, I think that, you know, we're a little ahead of ourselves in this debate, because this is a question basically for, you know, optimistically 8 months from now. But it is a question that we will have to address then, and that we probably should address in advance of then, given what we've seen about how slow state unemployment agencies are to adjust when you give them new rules to implement.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. As I said, that is definitely a future question. I think that this overtopping of even a $15 minimum wage, as you point out, does seem, you know, primed in purpose to set off the extreme pandemic disincentive. And when there is not a pandemic disincentive, then it certainly makes sense that that extra money will not be as strictly necessary. That said, I do think that we have to remember that, you know, a weak economy is made up not of just, you know, closing businesses, but people who do not have money to spend, who, you know, cannot go out and interact in the world as consumers or even as producers, people, you know, who cannot stay in their houses. If we want to have a strong economy, we can't just plunge a huge number of Americans into poverty, you know, removing any wage subsidy and, you know, pushing them further back, and then say, go out, spend, get things moving. They need to have something to spend. They need to have some security that makes it seem like they can go out and participate in the economy, because that is, in fact, what keeps businesses moving, what brings people back out into the world. If they are not able to do that, then the economy is going to be a non-starter.
Megan, so what do you, you say you're worried that a lot of restaurants and bars aren't going to reopen. I assume, presumably not because, unlike, you know, maybe mall retail, will a lot of it will go away altogether. We're going to have restaurants and bars in the future, but I assume what you're pointing to is it's hard for a business to last through a year of lost revenue, and so the specific businesses will fail. What do you do about that? I mean, Christine, I think, makes a good point that supporting consumer demand, which the law has done a good job of doing over the last few months, consumer spending has actually been surprisingly strong. Household savings have been good. I don't know if that will continue if the unemployment benefits aren't extended in the manner that they have been given out so far. But so, I mean, you can do that support from the consumer side, but what does a policy look like to keep those businesses afloat to the extent possible? I mean, one key example you have, the airlines got this big bailout from the federal government that basically runs through September 30th. Now United and American are coming back saying, well, do this for several more months because we're not ready to come back yet. Do you want the government handing aid to specific companies to say, basically, let's keep you afloat until things get back more to normal for you?
That's a really hard question for consumers. I was certainly an advocate of temporary bridge loans. You know, my idea was like you fund 90% of business operation expenses, provided that they keep 95% of their payroll.
But so when you say loans, you mean loans that they would have to pay back or
forgivable grants? You know, it never happened. So it was sort of irrelevant, right? We did do some of these loans. They haven't worked out very well for a number of reasons.
Well, we've done hundreds of billions of dollars of that through the PPP program for small businesses.
Yeah. And I think it has helped, but I think it's, you know, a restaurant can't keep going and paying rent for 18 months if there's no restaurant. I think that there were ways that we could have been more creative in trying to help, you know, restaurants like shift their business model, although restaurants have often been very creative in figuring out new things that they can do. I just don't know if it's enough. I don't know exactly what we could have done if we didn't get the pandemic response right. And that is that, you know, my assumption in March when I was advocating these things was that there was some sort of base level competence that someone would kind of step forward, that Donald Trump would not continue to undercut his own virus control policies for no reason that I've ever been able to discern. And so I had presumed that we would have a more experience, more like France, more like, you know, even Spain or Italy, but that eventually there would come a point where it was largely under control and we could start putting the economy back together in a relatively short time frame. And that is the opposite of what happened.
Yeah, I mean, Christine Megan notes that it's a tough question for conservatives whether the government should sort of shovel money to subsidize businesses to get through this. I don't think it's just a tough question for conservatives. I think it's also a tough question for liberals. And the answer to the question depends in part on how much money you're going to have to shovel to them and how long you're going to have to do it for. There are things that, you know, if you say, well, it's a three-month crisis and we're going to have to bridge you for 3 months, that might make sense. But if you're going to have to do it for a year, maybe it's no longer affordable or maybe it's no longer sensible. I mean, I go back to the example of the airlines. We gave $25 billion or Congress appropriated $25 billion for grants to keep airlines out of bankruptcy. That was at the request not just of management, but of the employee unions who wanted to retain their jobs, who did not want their contracts to be voided in a bankruptcy. And so $25 billion was a lot of money. But now that money is spent and the airlines are in no position to return to normal business in the fall. And so do you give them another $25 billion? When you look at the PPP program for small businesses, I think, you know, as Megan notes, there are some restaurants for whom the terms didn't work. There are other small businesses whose businesses were not necessarily impacted that much. And the PPP grants were sort of a windfall to the owners. And so it seems like there are economic benefits to shoveling this money out. But it's a lot of money, often to people who are already relatively wealthy. And a lot of it is not very well targeted. It's like, you know, we talked about with the school districts, whether the aid will be well targeted. I mean, we've given a lot of aid to businesses, which is not necessarily well targeted. And we've sort of recognize that in a crisis like this, some of the aid's not going to be well targeted.
Of course. I mean, you're running a government. Governments do, in fact, have budgets. Money is not actually a fake thing, although, you know, it sometimes sounds like it is, especially in times like these. But I'm always like vaguely amused and disappointed by conservatives and Republicans, especially saying like, oh, you know, this is a really hard decision. We have to be really cautious. We don't want to explode the deficit. We can't spend too much. Where was that, you know, cautious, nervous energy when we were giving a $1.5 trillion tax cut to millionaires and billionaires? Nobody seemed very worried about the cost then. And those people certainly didn't need the money back.
I was personally dramatically opposed to it, screamed that it was raising the deficit, and also thought it was mostly a stupidly structured tax cut. So I would just like to say, hashtag not all conservatives.
Good point. Not all conservatives. That makes sense. And in this moment, though, I think, you know, caution is warranted. We want to think about the future. But again, governments are supposed to serve the people. The purpose of the government is to make sure that the country and its citizens can function. If people are, you know, in fear of losing their homes, in losing their food, if the economy is going to shut down and then perhaps, you know, sputter along for many months at a time, essentially plunging, you know, millions of people into poverty, then right now, you know, the government does have to act. Spending is what is needed. You know, we can continue to tweak and tinker with what that spending looks like, the official dollar amounts. But we need to fix this emergency. We need to address the real demands of human people. The deficit, you know, while that is something that's important to think about. It's an interesting concept. I'm less interested in that in this moment than making sure that children have food to eat and that families have roofs over their heads.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Christine Emba and Megan McArdle of The Washington Post. We'll be back with Jeff Ingersoll from The Daily Caller to talk about what's going on in Portland. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist at The Washington Post. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf wants to be clear. The federal law enforcement officers who have been pulling people off the street in Portland and into unmarked vehicles and detaining them are not paramilitaries. Reuters annoyed Wolf by using this terminology, which it used because the law enforcement officers were dressed in military-style camouflage uniforms and didn't have badges. The latter, a step DHS says it has taken because law enforcement officers get threats if members of the public know who they are. The Trump administration says cities like Portland have failed to quell disorder associated with ongoing protests and have allowed destruction of federal property, such as the vandalism of courthouses and monuments. So DHS personnel has been sent in officially to back up the Federal Protective Service that ordinarily protects those federal properties. But the president has been clear in his own comments that he's responding to what he sees as a broad failure by states and localities to do their job in enforcing the law. Elected officials in Oregon have objected strenuously to the unwanted federal intervention. Congressman Earl Blumenauer, who represents Portland, said, "There is no excuse for the violent and unlawful tactics that this administration has used against my constituents in Portland. This was a made-for-TV provocation, and it must stop now," unquote. To talk about this, I want to bring in Jeff Ingersoll. Jeff was long ago my colleague at Business Insider. He's now editor-in-chief of The Daily Caller. Hi, Jeff.
Thanks for bringing me on, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Of course. So it seems to me there are three separate questions about this issue, and I'd like to take them in order. One is whether there's a proper federal law enforcement role here at all, since this action seems to have gone well beyond the nominal purpose of protecting federal properties. The second question is, even if there's a proper purpose to send in federal law enforcement, are they doing it in a proper and lawful manner? And the third question is, even if there's not a proper federal role, is the Trump administration right to say that states and localities have failed in their own role by being too lax? For example, in Seattle's toleration of a police-free so-called autonomous zone, which was shut down only after two people were killed in gun violence. So, Jeff, what is the justification for sending in the feds here, even if you don't like how Portland or Oregon has been handling the situation?
Right. So it's been 54 straight days or 55 straight days of riots and violence from these protesters. And I want to be clear, when I say protesters, I'm not talking about BLM. My own experiences with BLM, with the Black Lives Matter movement, when they see violence, they say, "This is not our message." I was in DC with them. They were picking up their own litter. I don't think that this is Black Lives Matter. I think that this is a violent left-wing group that has sort of hijacked the moment. And so this particular group in Portland has been going on for 55 days recently. I think my acid test for this kind of thing is, can regular apolitical bystanders, do they have the ability of free association in these areas? These are taxpaying citizens, they're law-abiding citizens. Can they freely associate in these areas? For a while, they haven't been able to. The mayor hasn't been able to quell the violence. He requested National Guard from the governor. The governor supplied National Guard for support-only purposes. At this point, I do think it's justified to bring in federal troops, or federal officers. I do think, though, that the execution was a bit off. There's definitely some issues with how they were deployed. And I don't know if you know, Josh, the unit that was out there, but it was like a special operations unit for CPB. And these guys are tuned up dudes. I mean, I don't know if it was a matter of, look, these guys are just free because there's not many border crossings, or if it was a message that Trump wanted to send, and maybe that's what it was. But I do think that it was a bit over the top and it could have been handled better, even if justified.
Megan, what do you make of this idea that if the state and local government isn't doing what the federal government perceives as their job, that then federal police can just step in?
Well, I mean, we have federal services that protect courthouses. We have a national park police here in Washington that, you know, dealt with a lot of protests, not well. But, you know, I'm not sort of inherently opposed to the idea that a federal service would protect federal property. That is actually pretty longstanding principle. I think the question is the actual execution of this effort to Brit. I think that, you know, first of all, the kind of escalation of the response was totally out of proportion to the threat. I'm not saying that I'm in favor of people burning down courthouses, but this is really, you know, what's the absolute worst thing that could happen? Does it justify sending people in camo uniforms into a city in order to like grab people and stuff them into vans? I don't think so. And so I think that's the big part of the problem is like, look, Donald Trump is not doing this because it's necessary. He is doing this because he thinks that if he can provoke a confrontation with the protesters, that it will redound to his benefit in the coming election. Ironically, I do not think that is helping him. But I also don't think that it's helped that the protesters are helping any cause that they stand for, right? I'm not talking about all of the protesters. I'm talking about the ones who are trying to set fire to the courthouse. That's not helpful. And I think either side would be better if they just stopped, if they just broke it off, pulled back and said, you know what, this was a bad idea. And neither of those two extreme groups, the feds on one hand and the firefighters on the other, seem to be able to bring themselves to just say, hey, guys, you know what, if we didn't do this, like we would be doing better out of this conflict.
Christine, I find remarkable the framing we have there from Megan is sort of two extreme groups, one of which is, you know, an sort of quasi-anarchist protest group in Portland, and the other of which is the federal government of the United States.
This discussion to the point of whether, you know, what the federal response is for reminds me of when the same sort of discussion was actually happening around Washington, D.C., where I live. The president was calling the National Guard, saying that the situation was completely out of control. Everything was terrible. I was fielding phone calls from, you know, friends and family members out of state saying, are you okay? Like, what's happening in D.C.? Is the whole city on fire? No, it was not. In fact, there are protests happening, but most of the people in D.C. at the time, and in fact, if you actually talk to people in Portland, most of the people in Portland at this time are living, you know, as perfectly normal lives as they can under a pandemic. This has been used as an attention-getting tactic by the president, and in fact, it's distracting attention from, you know, either families just trying to live or the more pressing problems of the pandemic and our response to it, or racial inequality and our response to that. This is a sideshow. The president is blowing it up into more of a sideshow. Unfortunately, these protesters that are acting erratically are turning it into a sideshow. But, you know, this does not matter. The thing that is most alarming here, in fact, is the unregulated, you know, presence of federal police. The problem is not that real, except the threat from an overpowerful and overarching government that has become more apparent over time.
Jeff, there was a point in late May, early June, where there was really a lot of unrest in cities around the country, not just protests, but fairly widespread looting in a lot of places. That's when you had the incident in Washington, D.C. that Christine refers to. And most of that has died down. And so I think that at the time you had the president sort of talking about the need for federal intervention to put that stuff down. And in fact, it turns out that either cities and states got a handle on it or things burn themselves out. And there's, you know, there's been a lot less, you know, petty crime of that sort in cities, and protests have been more orderly. Obviously, you have some exceptions to that. I think, to your point, the situation in Portland is somewhat unusual compared to nationally, but that leads to two questions for you. One is, given that what's going on in Portland looks pretty unusual, isn't that an argument against federal intervention? That in fact, you know, that cities and states have demonstrated they do have the tools to handle these issues themselves, and if they choose not to, that's sort of Portland and Oregon's problem. And then the second is the president has continued to talk about the desire to take this nationally. He's threatened to send federal forces into Chicago to enforce the law there, into Albuquerque. And so if this is really about a specific problem in Portland, what would the argument be for doing it in other cities?
Well, I got to disagree with you on one point in particular, Josh. And I don't know if it's directly linked to the protest, but I do think that it's correlated. You know, violent crime rates have been increasing in a lot of these cities. A lot of the local governance has been hesitant to take on these protests, whether it's political political expediency or what have you. And so I do think that there's a need to restore order in a general sense. And I do think specifically in Portland and maybe some other cities. Now, I pull up short. There are some cities that Donald Trump has mentioned that I think have it perfectly under control. And the libertarian streak in me is hesitant to ask for any federal, to see any federal expansion into American cities, especially American cities that don't need it. But I think the idea that the violence has gone down is just wrong. And I'm not surprised to see him make a move in Portland, even as I disagree with some of the details.
I didn't mean to say that violent crime rates have gone down necessarily in the last few weeks. I think there are indications that they are elevated. Unfortunately, the quality of that data is not great. Matt Iglesias had this observation this week that the U.S. Department of Agriculture can tell you how many chickens were killed in the U.S. in the last week, but you sort of have to wait 18 months to find out about the number of murders. But I think that the fact that the level of rioting and disorder and also the level of protests have fallen a lot without the violent crime appearing to necessarily similarly fall suggests to me that that they may not be terribly closely related. So that makes me wonder, to the extent that we are seeing an increase in violent crime in some cities, I wonder if that will just resolve itself once the broader issues that we're going through in the country right now resolve themselves. I'm not sure that it will, but it does make me really doubt that the federal government coming in, especially in such a heavy-handed manner, and frankly, what I think is an unlawful manner, to the extent that they have gone beyond simply protecting federal properties, it makes me really skeptical that that's actually a useful intervention to the extent that we even do have an increased problem with violence in cities. Christine, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to say. Cities have a better idea of what is going on in their districts than the federal government does. I mean, this is, why we have federalist principles. Again, I would just have to say that this is more a sideshow than anything else.
I think that Donald Trump feels like it's super macho to send in, his amped up federal policing units. But I think that it's a huge mistake. It escalates situations that should be de-escalated. But also, they're just not going to be good at that job. That's not what they're trained for. That's not what they are, good at doing. And that is the reason why the federal government should not be intervening into what are essentially local policing problems. That is what you get. And why, the founding fathers and generations of conservatives after that were so skeptical of standing armies and of this kind of militarization of policing problems.
So if we take the federal government out of the equation here, if we say, if we take Megan's point that the federal government is really not very well positioned, and I would also add often does not have the legal authority to intervene in these situations, where does that leave states and localities? Are there things they need to be doing differently? I mean, Christine, to Jeff's point about the police pulling back after their public outrages about things that the police do, I think there is complicated public opinion in cities among minority communities who have a lot of grievances about police brutality, but who also don't necessarily want the sort of undeclared strike that a lot of police seem to have gone on in cities where they say, well, if you're going to put us under this scrutiny, then we're not going to go in and enforce the law and there'll be unsolved murders. So what do state and local officials need to be doing differently in that environment?
That position of police officers, frankly, is just so petty and unhelpful. And yes, this has been a long running debate in over-policed, frankly, and over-policed and at the same time under-policed communities that are poor and often communities of color in major cities. And I think that, in this moment, as we discuss what the police should and should not be doing, and even as we discuss, the idea of defunding the police, what the state and local organizations could be looking at is, what else should we be doing here? If there's an uptick in some sort of violent crime, what can we be doing to, address these problems that doesn't involve relying on police officers who are reluctant to work because they've been protested again? And this is where, to Megan's point, state and local departments, state and local police forces, state and local officials simply have a better view as to what their communities look like, what their communities need, and what alternative methods could be useful. These Department of Homeland Security mystery police know nothing about this, and they're not helpful in this moment. But this is an opportunity for state and local police to, in fact, question and perhaps expand their roles in a different and more helpful direction.
Jeff, is it an oversimplification to say police are government employees, low morale is not an excuse for not doing their jobs, and that the solution to the sort of the pullback in policing is to hold public employees accountable, terminate them as necessary, and have police who will be willing to do what they're instructed?
I do think it's a bit of an oversimplification. At the same time, I could understand why Christine would call it petty, and I do think that police... As a former Marine myself, I do think that if you have a duty to do, you should be doing it unless otherwise instructed. So I do think they should still be out in these communities. The last thing you want to do is pull back, I think. I've seen this play out in a number of different contexts as a reporter. I covered Occupy Wall Street for New York Daily News from soup to nuts, from beginning to end. And there's only one way these things end, which is a restoration of order and the deterrence of justice. And so at the end of the day, what it's going to take is the mayor and the governor saying that they've had enough. And we saw this with Chaz, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle. They were kind of content to let it go on. It was politically expedient, meaning they've shared political views with some of these protesters. It was politically expedient to let them, you know, run amok and do what they wanted. And then things went south real quick and they had to clean it out. And so I think, not to say anything about Donald Trump's moves, because I do think that Megan was 100% right here with, look, the Border Patrol, this is what they do. They run up on somebody, they throw them in a van. This is not a comment on Trump. I think he could have handled it better. But I think at the end of the day, we're talking about Portland. We're talking about 54 days straight of rioting and violence. This has nothing to do with Black Lives Matter. It's simply an excuse. And I think the only thing you really can do is the mayor has to step up and put police out on the streets and put bad people behind bars. That's really what it boils down to.
Jeff Ingersoll is editor-in-chief of the Daily Caller. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Christine Emba, it's your soapbox.
So earlier this week, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, introduced the Saving American History Act of 2020, a bill that would prohibit the use of federal funds to teach the 1619 Project in K-12 schools and districts. So just to be clear, the 1619 Project is an initiative from the New York Times Magazine that examines the legacy of slavery in the United States. So, first of all, doesn't Tom Cotton have anything better to do? I mean, there's a pandemic on right now. Arkansas, his state, in fact, is reporting a record rise in new community cases. Schools are struggling with how to provide any sort of learning, let alone dealing with Tom Cotton's harebrained calculations as to how to defund it. If this man feels so stupidly threatened by schools threatening to simply re-examine how they teach and talk about slavery, well, what is he actually against here? Maybe it highlights that this project is more important than we realized. And it also signals that Tom Cotton is once again wasting everybody's time.
Megan McArdle, what's on your mind?
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling for Republicans to eliminate the cap on the deductibility of state and local taxes as part of the relief package. This already ended up in the House package as a temporary lift on the cap, which was abolished under the Trump tax cuts in 2017. Now Charles Schumer wants to make it permanent. It's obvious why people in his state, which is very large, very rich, and has very high taxes, get a lot of benefit from the state and local tax deduction, but it is a ridiculous tax cut that does not deserve to live. First of all, the tax deduction goes mostly to the richest people who have high incomes that are subject to a lot of income tax and large houses that pay a lot of property tax on. Second of all, though, it goes to the richest people in the richest states in America. This is effectively a large transfer from the people of Mississippi to the people of New York. That is absurd. They should have some shame and stop asking for the rest of America to subsidize their high tax lifestyles.
For my rant, as Megan noted earlier in the show, restaurants have been getting creative about how to do business in the pandemic. In New York, where indoor dining is prohibited for good reason, restaurants have greatly expanded outdoor dining. They're being allowed to put tables in parking spaces outside the restaurants. But one innovation the government is not crazy about is a lot of outdoor drink service, sort of causing these impromptu bars to form on sidewalks where people are standing around drinking. And so the state has been more aggressively enforcing a rule that you have to buy food with your drinks. The idea is that they're to accompany a meal, and the food has to be, quote, substantial. So bars that had been selling people bags of potato chips, that doesn't count anymore. I understand the state's rationale here, why you need to have these sorts of rules around things. I just wish that they were clearer and more consistent about the rules and more cognizant of the fact that these businesses are under such intense financial pressure and we want them to continue to exist when the pandemic is over. So to the extent we can find ways that are safe for them to operate, we should give them to them. We shouldn't change the rules all the time. Governor Cuomo was saying at a press conference this week that chicken wings should not count as substantial food, that they're less substantial than a sandwich, and therefore they don't count. Now, especially if you're the governor of New York, which is the state where buffalo wings were invented, that seems like a kind of ridiculous position to take, and in fact, a spokesperson walked it back later in the day, said actually chicken wings do count as substantial food. But this is just part of a broader issue. These businesses, if they're going to survive, they shouldn't face constantly changing rules at the whims of a governor. The state should stay laser-focused on making sure that business operations don't spread the virus, and should otherwise err every way that it can on the side of keeping these businesses open and solvent. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Christine Emba, Megan McArdle, and Jeff Ingersoll. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.